I think we have to change our relationship with failure in general. I think a lot of the beliefs around failure is that failure is bad, and I don't want to sound too cliche, but failure is, I just think people have a backwards way of thinking about failure. I mean, failure is just learning, and it's just, so I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Sure,
it's hard. It's hard because it comes so natural to me that failure is just a big part of my life, and I plan to fail a lot more.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In the next few weeks, we're looking to redesign the Unmistakable Creative website. We know there are a lot of you in our community who are designers and developers. If you're a WordPress developer or designer, we'd love to hear from you. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/redesign to see the specs and tell us a bit more about your work and your portfolio. And as always, today's episode of the Unmistakable Creative is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. If you have an existing website and you want to move that website to HostGator, they make it simple and it's free to move. If you want to start a new website, they're providing 24/7 live support via phone chat and email, an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy, and one-click WordPress installs if you want to get your hands dirty. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, they're offering 30% off all of their hosting packages to listeners of the Unmistakable Creative. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Brian, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, thanks. It's really good to be here after all this time.
Yeah. So, you know, you and I have worked together for about 3 years. I've mentioned your name multiple times on the show. We've had numerous requests to have you come and talk and do like a full-blown interview. And we've done a few episodes where we've dissected interviews and shared some of our own ideas. But I'm really excited because I get to pick your brain on the air. And especially, you know, given that we've known each other for 3 years, and I know that you're a wealth of knowledge about all sorts of things. So
I've been hiding out.
Yeah, you have been hiding out. So it's very cool to finally do this in this format. So, you know, one of the things that'll be interesting, I think, in this conversation is that I know so much more about you than I probably do about our average guest. So, you know, I am going to ask you questions about things that I know you've told me about. So let's start at the very beginning. And this is something that I remember you told me once I should ask you about. And I know from having spent 3 years with you that you grew up in a small town called Lowell, Michigan. And I'm curious what impact having grown up in such a small town has ended up having on your life.
Well, growing up in the Midwest in general, I find that there's different values that people in the Midwest have, especially how they relate to other people. I don't know, I have this, partially I'll talk about it from a business perspective first, and if we need to talk about any other perspectives, we can. But one of the things, the positives that I learned is that your reputation is everything. And growing up in a small town, and especially having parents who are small town business owners, you learn that you really need to do the right thing all the time. Because if your neighbors don't like you, or you do wrong by a neighbor, your entire business could be up in smoke. And there, and plus just there's a very strong cultural value that regardless if money's on the table, you're just, you need to do the right thing. And you know, having a small community, there's the egotistical reputation, but there's the fact you have to live with these people for maybe the rest of your life. So that's impacted me. Most of my business relationships are pretty good, and I really freak out when people are, when I feel like they're getting wronged. And some of it has to do with my small town upbringing and the values that come with that. But one of the problems that's came up for me is I tend to believe what people say, because in the small town community, you can make deals on a handshake, and people were kind of held accountable by the environment of just being in that bubble. And I've learned even since moving to California that not everybody means what they say. And sometimes, well, actually a lot in business, people tend to make promises in best case scenarios. And I've had to figure that out, that a lot of times the promises that people are making or talking about possibilities, they're hypothetical best case scenarios. And the odds of a best case scenario happening is like getting all green lights from here to New York.
Sure. Yeah, definitely something else can happen. You know, one of the things that's really interesting is that you have this sort of small town, you know, perspective on you know, navigating the world of business, but you've also went and worked in big corporations like Sony PlayStation. So I'm curious how you took that small town dynamic and overlaid it into a place like PlayStation, because I mean, that's a very different environment than Lowell, Michigan. So like, what, you know, how do you take what you've learned from Lowell and translate it? And what, and in what ways did you have to adapt?
Okay. All right. So I'll start with the funny stuff first. The first thing I had to learn is that if somebody gives an excuse, for example, for being late, you don't try and help them with their excuse. You're supposed to go, oh, okay, that makes sense. So for example, someone would say, oh, sorry, I'm late, the traffic is so bad. Well, did you try this different? No, you don't go there. You just say, oh yeah, the traffic was bad. It's almost like this cultural thing just to let people off the hook. Because in Michigan, if somebody has a problem, you try to solve it with them. Or if somebody has an excuse, you try to remedy it. So I had to learn that. If somebody gives excuses, and it sounds so judgmental, but especially in big bureaucratic companies, you're not, it's un-PC to ask them any further questions about their excuse than just let them slide. So that was number one. The next thing that happened that I noticed at Sony was I had a very strong work ethic, because that's another thing from a small farming community, is you just have a tremendous work ethic. And one of the things I had to adjust to is that some people in big companies love that, and some people hate it. So what happens is, if you have a tremendous work ethic, you really shine a spotlight on the people that are just coasting, because a lot of people in big companies coast, let's face it. And so I was able to bring that small town work ethic and the small town values of really connecting with people and creating authentic goodwill. You know, I within a year had relationships with people in three different regions, and I started off as a small time kind of trainer, and before long I was very close to a senior director of a global operation. And yeah, so I think just that small town thinking of just treating everybody with tremendous respect and bringing positivity there, working hard, created a lot of opportunity, but that later created some problems too. And so,
you know, there's probably a lot of young people listening to this early in their career, probably much like you were in the early PlayStation days. And I'm curious, you know, what advice you would give to them in terms of navigating a work environment and being able to build relationships with people who, you know, ideally become mentors to them.
Wow. That's a really, really good question. The first thing I would say is that if you are hungry and humble, you'd be surprised at the amount of executives that want to talk to you. And there's so many executives that want people to just execute. They want to be able to coach people and see results. And a lot of people think there's this big wide gap between who they are now and who they need to be before they can start taking on big projects or talking to big time executives, or who's going to step on whose toes. And for me, I always just decided that, you know, I wanted to build, for example, I was concerned about job security, because as going through the recession earlier in my career, I've always been wanting to build security. And I looked at building connections in the company as building a safety net, because in a big company, if you have enough people that love you from all around the world, executives, HR professionals, that's going to, you know, be good for you. So one of the things that I would suggest is just build a net of relationships just everywhere you go. And then, you know, have courage. For me, I'm willing to go all in. And if I burn a bridge, then I'll leave the company.
Yeah.
And I just think having that type of courage is really, really important. And a lot of people just play it safe and are scared. And man, you're on a path to nowhere, especially in a big company. In order to make it up fast in a big company, you have to make big moves and take risks. And sometimes you're going to step on people's toes, and you have to figure out who's the winning team in the company and who's the losing team. There's always, in a big company, there's always people on both parties. Yeah. And align yourself with the winning team and just go for it.
You know, it's funny to hear you talk about winning and losing teams. I think back to a sales job that I had, and I remember one of my friends said, he's like, the guys you go to lunch with, he's like, that's a losing team. He's like, 'cause all they do is complain. And, you know, and I realized that group of guys all eventually left the company. But it was interesting that, you know, sort of became like I recognize it now when I hear you say that. I didn't at the time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people get in a mode that they just really are holding on too tightly to, you know, I talked about a bubble earlier. And a lot of times in companies, man, it might as well be another small town. Or like think about high school. And a lot of the people that listen are out of high school. And when you're in a company, it feels like high school all over again. And when you're in high school, you feel like the reality that you're in those moments are just how it's going to be for life. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the big problems that people run into, is they start hating their job or hating their boss or taking on assignments that don't resonate or settling. And it's way better just to not settle and tell people what you want. The right people will respect you for it. And if you aren't allowed to be yourself, you just get out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. Well, speaking of high school, I think, you know, one of the other things I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you every question you've told me to ask our guests. So on that note, what social group were you a part of in high school, and how did that influence your life?
Sure. I was in the skater group in high school, and that influenced my life in just a tremendous amount of ways. First of all, the skater group is fairly rebellious, and I think that's one of the first entrepreneurial type of influences on my life. Is as a skater, you look at the world just very differently. So everything out there outside, if it's concrete, it's a potential skate spot, and you're always just looking for opportunity everywhere.
Yeah.
The next thing is just I learned how to be just a little bit rebellious and be comfortable with being quote unquote rejected. Even though skateboarding has become a lot more cool, it was still one of those things where you're choosing to be somewhat of an outsider and kind of enjoy it. So that was one of the things that we had going for us. Just general willingness and excitement around breaking the rules was something that influenced me pretty tremendously.
Yeah.
And then skateboarding in general, I think really led to just my later kind of ability to fail. Mm-hmm. Because if anyone's watched skateboarders for more than 5 minutes, you'll realize that 80% of the things you try, you fail. And you fall all the time. So that was one of the things that I really got a thrill from, failing a lot and then getting something right and winning and having a big, big high from that.
Yeah. I'm really glad you brought up failure, because I think building a tolerance for failure, capacity to fail and to get back up again is something that's, hugely important. I think I've gotten it from surfing. Mm-hmm. Probably you have as well. And I'm curious, for people who are at that bone breaking age as I am and who can't get on a skateboard, I mean, how do people build their tolerance for failure? Like, what have you found have been effective methods, that aren't necessarily, things that could do physical harm to your body?
Building a tolerance for failure. I think just learning new skills, like being willing to take something on, I think following your curiosity. Mm-hmm. Is one of those things. Something I'll touch on briefly, because you asked about high school, it might be fairly telling, is I started off in middle school. I was kind of hanging out with the cool preppy kids. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that the cool preppy kids were making fun of the not cool kids. And there was this one kid in particular that everyone would make fun of. And I was the only one in the school that wouldn't. And he would come sit by me, and all my super cool, air quoting right now, preppy friends would leave. And it would be just me and this kid. And I just thought it was so hypocritical that, at that point, the preppy or kind of jock kids, they were looked upon as like, oh, these kids are so good and you're part of the cool, popular group.
Yeah.
I was like, man, I don't want anything to do with this. So I ended up going with the skateboarders, who turned out they weren't any nicer to this kid, but at least they were not being fake.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I just wanted to share that as well.
Yeah.
As far as failure, being comfortable with it, I don't know. I mean, I think we have to change our relationship with failure in general. I think a lot of the beliefs around failure is that failure is bad. And I don't want to sound too cliche, but failure is, I just think people have a backwards way of thinking about failure. I mean, failure is just learning.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Sure.
It's hard because it comes so natural to me that failure is just a big part of my life, and I plan to fail a lot more.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I want to spend some time talking about learning and education, because the thing that has always struck me about you is that, you said so yourself that you were kind of not categorized as book smart in a classroom, but I've spent 3 years with you. You're quite book smart as far as I'm concerned. And, I'm curious about the choices that you've made in terms of how you chose to learn and how you chose to develop yourself. And also knowing that a lot of parents are listening who have children who are in, formal educational institutions, what would you tell them based on your experience?
Okay. Well, I hope the school system has changed a little bit since I've been out I graduated in 2004. But one of the things that happened when I was young is as early as second grade, I had a teacher, you know, share with my mom that, hey, there's something possibly wrong with Brian, and it's something that's not going to go away. And ironically enough, I was also in advanced reading at that point. So there was some really interesting disconnect happening with my learning, where apparently I had a learning disability, which I was later diagnosed with ADD, just like half the population, it seems.
Yeah.
So what ended up happening, and my biggest fear with going through the whole diagnosis process is I didn't want to find out that I was stupid for some reason. Obviously that's just devastating in general. But I just, looking back, it was extremely frustrating, because I think the studies that I've done as of late, especially, I think I had some overexcitabilities intellectually and imaginatively. And what that ended up causing was I would get bored extremely easily. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff that I saw in class, I mean, I don't want to sound super cliche, but I just didn't see how it applied to life. And I would look at the teacher and I would know how they were doing emotionally. And I'd be like, I wonder what's going on in their life. And I'm not paying attention. And you know, just this, just school in general, the current system that I was in just didn't resonate. So I ended up going through the grades as like a C student and, uh-huh. and just feeling, you know, kind of dumb and pretty disengaged, pretty jaded. I felt bitter about the whole situation, and to the extent that I refused to take my ACTs or SATs, uh-huh. because by the time I was in high school, I really got a grasp of the fact that it wasn't that I was stupid, it was that in my arrogance at that time being a skateboarder, I just thought I was smarter than everybody else, and it made me just want to beat the system.
Yeah.
And my other fear with taking these tests is I didn't want a test that couldn't understand me to be able to label me. So I really became frustrated with education as a labeling device, which it so clearly is. I don't know if it still is today, but it was then. And it just made me rebel against, I didn't want to go to college or any of that stuff.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by DesignCrowd. Unmistakable Creative listeners have used DesignCrowd for logo, web, and graphic design. Here's how it works. You go to designcrowd.com and you set up your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 designers from around the world. If you like the designs you get, you can then approve payment. If you don't like what you get, you can go back to the crowd and ask for more, or ask for your money back. To see what other Unmistakable Creative listeners have designed and save $100 on your first project, visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for $100 off. Today's episode is also sponsored by our friends at HostGator. They host your website and they have 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email. An easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy, one-click WordPress installs, and if you want to switch from an existing host to HostGator, it's free and it's simple. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting 30% off all of their hosting packages. So visit HostGator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off.
It's interesting that you know, something that every high school student does. Like if I told my parents, I'm not going to take the SATs or ACT, they'd be like, what the hell? Especially given that my dad is a college professor, like that would never go down. But it's, I think the more interesting sort of takeaway for me is that you didn't accept reality as it was, and you actually saw it as something that you could shape to your own liking. Mm. And I am curious how people develop that, and how that has developed over the course of your life since then.
Mm. How somebody can develop the ability to
shape reality to their own liking.
Mm. Well, I think I came to the realization that the typical system and way of life as a whole wasn't going to work for me. So I had a choice to either let go of any dreams of having something awesome happen in my life, or I had to find another path. And I think if people are really real, you know, you have a quote in the book that you wrote, Unmistakable, that I just shared, that I knew where that path led. If I just kept letting, you know, society label me, if I kept not recognizing my own gifts and kept just following through on the typical day-to-day grind, I could see all around me, the writing was all over the wall and where that path was going to lead. And I think, you know, for other people, if you're just real about your situation and look at, you know, what's working, what's not working in your life, and is the system working for you or against you? And I think if you just look at what you're doing now, if you map out the next 20 years, I think you'll find that it might not get you where you want to go. And then you just have to think, okay, so this system isn't working, so what's an alternate path that you can take? Mm-hmm. And
so I want to spend some time talking about the skateboard company, but I want to approach this a little bit differently in terms of how we started. You know, I know that you got to see your parents build a business over the course of your life from, you know, early childhood all the way to actually seeing it, you know, be this really successful thing. So I'm curious what you learned from them that you applied to starting a skateboard company, and two, what in the world gave you the audacity as a high school student to think that, you know what, I'm going to start a skateboard company?
Okay. So question one, well, I used to tell my parents in middle school that I never wanted to own a business because I saw the amount of intensity and commitment that it took and the amount of crap you had to go through. So you'll have people quit on you, stab you in the back, you know, sometimes lawsuits or whatever, and you're working, you know, way harder than the average person. So it's like, why bother? And then I saw the excitement of it and the thrill of it and then some of the rewards of it as I came into high school. And it was just fun. It was exciting. And I think being a skateboarder, I liked the adrenaline kind of nature of entrepreneurship, just having something different every day and something just that stimulating. Mm-hmm. So that really impacted me. And as far as the audacity to start my own business in high school, it came down from, I think it stems just from that whole wanting to beat the system attitude. And I thought, I could get a really, you know, crappy job, or I could start my own business and probably make more money, which I did. Mm-hmm. But probably it came down to, I really wanted to be a professional skateboarder. Like, you know, if you ask any high schooler that is skating or surfing or snowboarding, mm-hmm. they'd be lying to you if they didn't say they didn't want to be a professional in that sport.
Yeah.
And when I started realizing that I didn't have the talent to be a professional skateboarder, it was one of those things just like in school where I saw that that system wouldn't support my vision. Mm-hmm. So I had to create an alternate path. And I thought, okay, how can I stay in the skateboarding industry, live that same really cool rock star lifestyle? Well, I could start a business. And so at 17 years old, I tricked the county clerk into giving me a doing business as license, thinking I was 18. Mm-hmm. And we got our first business license, me and a partner, actually a DBA, not a business license. And we just got started. And I used the work ethic that I saw from my parents in building that business, and within, you know, by the time I was 19 and a half, we had 27 stores, you know, selling our products. Hmm.
You know, I want to touch briefly on money stories, and I want to come back to this later on, but I'm curious, you know, how having that sort of level of financial success when you're in high school, where you have more money than you could possibly use, I'd imagine, at an age where that is not normal, like, how did that impact your money story, and you know, what impact did that end up having later on?
Well, I've never had so much money I couldn't use it. That's never been a problem.
But that's a lot of money for a kid in high school.
Yeah, I always had $500 in my pocket at minimum.
Which is a ton of money for a kid in high school.
Yeah. And, you know, how it impacted me. Well, it made me never want to have a job because I just saw jobs as extremely limiting and just not fun. Yeah. And I guess what I learned at that age is that, man, you could make more money by having a lot of fun in doing something that you really want to do than just following the normal, you know, rhythm of life and what you're quote unquote supposed to do. So as far as money story, I think deep down, I just knew that, like I used to say back in those days that I never wanted to make an hourly rate because I think it had to do with not wanting to be labeled again and not wanting to have anything put a label on me, whether it was a grade in school or a dollar amount per hour. It just seemed very, I never really connected that until now, but I think that was part of it, is it just made me not want to be labeled again in any way.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about the conversation you had with your mom about going to college, okay. Which I think is a fascinating conversation because I think the way that you approached it is really interesting, and you know what you chose to do instead is really interesting, and I want to talk about it and kind of, you know, tell us about it.
Sure. So I didn't want to go to college, as you know, as I shared, because I just thought college was a big scam, and in most ways I still think it is, and I just recognized that I was in high school, and again, I saw the system wasn't working for me, so why go belabor the system in my life? And I told my mom, I said, I'm a successful entrepreneur. I think she would disagree at that point. You know, running a much larger business and seeing, you know, the fact that we didn't have a tremendous amount of runway and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But she said, and my mom had supported, you know, most everything I'd ever wanted to do. So even as a kid, I'd tell my mom, I want to be a fighter pilot, firefighter, this or that. She's always like, awesome, you should do it. I want to start my skateboard company. Awesome, you should do it. So I kind of expected that when I said, hey, I don't want to go to college. College is a scam. And my mom said, if you don't go to college, you're cut off. you have to move out and all this other stuff. And I thought, okay, well, I was very disappointed because I just thought I didn't want to be labeled. Now I have to go back into a system that's going to label me and by a degree or grade point average or whatever. So I decided that I was going to go to flight school. And I had been exposed to flying and aviation because I wasn't a great student. And I had the opportunity in high school to be a part of a like half in school and like half out of school and like some sort of other program type of a thing. It's called KCTC. And I got a chance to work on airplanes. And I remember just looking one morning, I was watching the sunrise. I even got up early for this, which was cool. Watching the sunrise, and I saw a plane landing with the sunrise in the background, and just something hit me. And I just thought, man, I want to fly airplanes. So when I knew I had to go to college, then I decided to fly airplanes. So I went to flight school, and I was still building my business, which it didn't go as well while I was in flight school for obvious reasons. I mean, you just can't focus on college. In high school, I was just totally not engaged in building a business, but in college, in flight school especially, it's a little bit more difficult. And being at a distance from my partner, I ended up selling my half of the business while I was in college. So that's how that conversation went, and my mom won. And I got my pilot's license.
So, I mean, you ultimately decided not to become a pilot. I'm curious what lessons from the world of aviation you have applied to how you run businesses, how you do all the things that you do now. Because I know that there have to be tons of lessons.
Yeah, well, I decided I didn't want to be a commercial pilot because I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I didn't actually even finish college. As I got my pilot's license, I ended up leaving college at that point, but I didn't go all the way through. You know, I'm sure a lot of people that are listening are familiar with aviation. I didn't go through. I only got my VFR license. I didn't go all the way through to commercial. As far as what I apply today, man, it takes a lot of courage to fly an airplane. Yeah. And you have to juggle a lot of things at once, and you really have to keep your cool. So one of the things I learned, and I've always been generally good at keeping my cool, but you learn very quickly that in an airplane, especially when you're learning and flying by yourself for the first time, you just have to keep it together. You have to learn how to take a deep breath, and there's a lot of moving parts. And as long as you stay relaxed, it's going to work out. And you learn that when you fly. You just have to. There's no other choice. And even if things are going wrong, like I had a point in my flight training where I did panic a bit, and that was extremely horrifying. And I was on my first cross-country solo, which means in my first solo flight that's going at a distance. And I just learned from that experience. I ended up breathing through it and just relaxing, and everything worked out. I just didn't aim for the ground. I just kept going straight and figured it out. And I just learned later that if you just relax into the challenges and just take a few steps back, that you can just overcome it. The other thing I learned is that people told me I shouldn't go to flight school because I wasn't good at math. And there I was, and succeeded and got my license. So I just learned again that letting other people label me was just a joke.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, I'm the Indian guy who sucks at math, and you're the one who runs the finances of the business.
I don't like math. That just doesn't have a meaning to me at that point. Now, yeah. I think math is super interesting because I see all these different ways to use it.
Just a quick reminder for those of you who are interested or didn't hear the ad at the beginning of the episode. In the next few weeks, we're looking to redesign the Unmistakable Creative website, and we know there are a lot of you in our community who are designers and developers. If you're a WordPress developer or designer, we'd love to hear from you. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/redesign to see the website specs and tell us a bit more about your work and your portfolio. So, something that I personally have not really gotten to ask you about in as much depth as I've wanted to, and I wanted to save this question for this conversation, is, you know, something that you told me and something that I knew would be a huge part of this conversation, and that is this notion of talking to 10,000 strangers. The fact that you have walked up to 10,000 strangers and started conversations with them. There's not very many people who I think have had that experience. And so I want to talk about, one, why in the hell did you do that? Because people are like, okay, that sounds sociopathic if they didn't understand the context.
Sure.
what did it teach you about human behavior and social dynamics and relationships? And how do you apply the lessons from that today? Which are like four questions in one, but you should be used to that by now.
Okay, so I'll start with why it was only partially crazy. And that's when I was in flight school, I sold my skateboarding business and I joined a network marketing company, which that's just all sorts of things we could talk about with that. And I was with a company called Amway. Great products. The team I was with at the time wasn't a great fit for me. But the thing that caught me, just like all network marketing companies, is I wanted the freedom. Mm-hmm. And when I lost the vision to become a professional skateboarder, I still wanted to build my company and have the freedom that a professional skateboarder would have. But then I sold that business, so I was looking for freedom again. And in network marketing, I found a group of people, like normal, well-adjusted adults, that had the audacity to dream and talk about freedom and really want financial independence. So I found a place of belonging and decided to join Amway and really go all in on that. So part of joining Amway is you're not really allowed to advertise using any traditional means. So you have to go talk to people, you know, friends and family and that type of thing. Well, anyone that's ever tried this stuff before, they know that you run out of friends and family pretty quickly to talk to, and you have a few battle scars by the end of that. So I was very committed to this idea of freedom, and Amway is very any network marketing company that's successful is great at keeping a vision in front of you of freedom. They constantly are just pumping you with success story after success story after success story. So I just wanted to be that. And one of the things that they would celebrate in the success story is the struggle victory, and they'd like to paint themselves as the underdog that eventually became successful, which really encourages people in network marketing to bang their head against the wall because you want to be that struggle victory story. Well, yeah. I've learned later that the more you crush struggle out of your life, the more you can become successful. But at the time, I thought struggle was great, which is very different than my skateboarding business. Yeah. So as far as talking to 10,000 strangers, so after I ran out of friends and family to talk to, I started having to talk to random people. So I would go out, and every day after work, I was working in tech support at that point. So I left flight school and joined a company called EDS, which was later bought by Hewlett Packard, doing really crappy tech support work. And then in the evenings, I'd spend my time, you know, building Amway. Uh-huh. And I would just go out every day. And my goal for good portions of it was I wanted to get at least two people's names and numbers a day.
Yeah.
It later got to five people's names and numbers a day. And I knew for every four people I talked to, I'd get one name and number, typically. Uh-huh. So I'd go talk to, you know, 8 to 10 people every day, just strike up a cold conversation, gas station or a mall. And then I would get two of their names and numbers, and then try to, you know, show them the presentation for Amway. And so I spent a lot of time talking to strangers. And I don't know, I learned a lot from it. Some of the biggest lessons are, gosh, I got to see people from how they first impression to how they behaved, whether people were good for their word or not good for their word. I mean, obviously, I take some responsibility for that being, you know, the communicator.
Sure.
But I could very quickly pick up, even just by looking at somebody move, just walking, I could see how open-minded they were. I could see if they were happy, if they were unhappy, if they were... Often I could predict what people did for a living. Uh-huh. So there was, you know, I remember just one exchange stands out to me where I walked up to a guy and I forgot my opening line. I said, "Hey, are you from around here or something?" And the way he answered, I said, "Oh, you're a Cooley Law student, right?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "How'd you know that?" I was like, "I just knew. I could tell." and I just got to the point that I could read people within seconds of seeing them. Uh-huh. And I just got really good at that. And the being able to read people now pays off in a lot of ways. It can also be fairly distracting because you just tend to, you know, I guess see the world through almost, it's almost an over, you have more data than you want.
Right.
I learned a little, I mean, mostly I learned about myself because it takes quite a bit to just go up to random strangers all the time.
Yeah.
And get people's names and numbers.
Yeah. I mean, this was so interesting to me because I remember the handful of times, you know, I've been at a bar with you being single. You're like, I could probably tell you which girl in this bar will actually give you her phone number. I'm like, that's useful. I'm like, I don't give a shit about Amway. I want to know about that. What I'm curious about, tell me about some of the more uncomfortable conversations that you had to have, the ones where people didn't want to be talking to you. And how do you navigate situations like that? What did you learn from those?
Well, there were times where I wanted to hit people because, you know, at the time I really felt like my intentions were pure and which gave me the ability to do that. If I felt like it was unethical, then I probably wouldn't have been able to go out with the intensity and consistency that I did. So part of it was, I learned to like the rejection to a degree. Uh-huh. I learned to like the adversity. But another thing is it started teaching me about numbers, where I knew that if I could get enough people to tell me no. So one of the ways I got through it mentally, and this might work for salespeople or any business owner out there, who knows, is I would look at the numbers and I'd say, okay, I just need five people to tell me no today.
Yeah.
And sometimes by the time you got five people to tell you no, seven people would have told you yes. So you're just trying to get somebody to tell you no at that point. And it ends up being fun.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I learned is that you have to play offense. If I went out there, I used to think about the shield versus the sword, and the shield is where you're like ducking for cover, and you have to be aggressive and play offense if you're going to, you know, maintain anything like that, and really build a strong sense of your own identity. So yeah, when you get, you know, five people, I guess there's a lot of people out there probably haven't had five people tell them no in a week or maybe their life, but yeah, five a day. Uh-huh. So I just had to develop my own just my own sense of, I see something that they don't, and I'd maintain my own vision, which I kind of always have had that, but you learn to navigate loneliness too.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're out there by yourself, and you know, there's a lot of people do treat you very disrespectfully, and you know, rightfully so, you know, in some regard. If I'm just like stopping them at a mall, I mean, that's pretty annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But I just had to learn how to, you know, develop that mental toughness, and probably some of the mental toughness from skateboarding, you know, came into play there.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing that's interesting to me is, you know, you brought up like this numbers idea. And I was thinking about that in the context of my own writing process, right? 1,000 words a day, you know, I'm like, okay, if I write 1,000 words a day, at least two sentences is bound to be semi, you know, coherent and usable. You know, and it seems to me like a very similar process that could be applied to just about any other area of your life. If you think about it in terms of, okay, I'm just aiming for a number, which is a very much process orientation instead of outcome orientation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, what you'll end up learning if you want to build any skill or craft or business is that you have to really get into the numbers and less about the daily emotion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So this is another thing. Were there moments in, you know, talking to all of these people where you really just, you wanted to quit and you wanted to give up? And what did you do in those moments? How did you navigate those moments and manage your own emotions through them?
Wow. There were so many days I wanted to give up and quit. Part of it had to do with stubbornness, because I just wanted to prove to everybody that thought it was stupid that that it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there was a lot of lonely nights, because I was part of competitions even at that time that I would go head to head with people and say, hey, whoever doesn't get their two contacts loses for months at a time, actually 30 days at a time, but I'd often go back to back. So some nights it was hard enough, and cold Michigan nights, that I wouldn't get my second contact. And I'm going to reveal how crazy I am here, until like 2 or 4 in the morning.
Wow.
So I'd have to find like places that were open. People are much less receptive at 2 a.m. on a cold winter night than 6 p.m.
Yeah.
So as far as managing the wanting to quit, gosh, I think again, it had to do with knowing where the path of quitting led me. Uh-huh. And I just thought, if I quit, I don't know what else to do. And I'm certainly not going to sit here in this cubicle job all, you know, the rest of my life. And
yeah.
One of the downsides to network marketing, and especially that organization, is they tend to, well, I think the military does this too, from what I've heard, is they program you to think that it's either that or you're nobody. And they'd kind of, even though I'd already built a successful company, they'd reprogram my brain to a degree, and I let me say this, as I allowed them to, because mm-hmm. it's not their fault, it's mine. That I just thought, if it's not this, you know, there's nothing else. I wasn't experienced enough to know that there's a million ways to have financial freedom and enjoy your life, or even just make good money. I learned later that financial freedom is kind of a joke. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's not possible. That shouldn't be the goal. So part of it was, if it's not this, then what? Mm-hmm. So that was part of it. And yeah. actually, it wasn't until later, and I had this never quit mentality, but it wasn't until later I read a book by Seth Godin that mm-hmm. allowed me to be comfortable with quitting, and that was called The Dip. Mm-hmm. And everyone in Amway at the time would suggest that quitters were losers and all this stuff, and Seth Godin started sharing in this book that oftentimes the most successful business owners in the world quit often. They quit fast, and they move on to stuff that works. And that was one of the first things that led me to go, wow, this business isn't working. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of reasons for that. But I'd enrolled a lot of people, and then the team that I was a part of just wasn't resonating with the people that I was enrolling.
Yeah.
And so later it became, I finally figured out quitting was a sign of intelligence, not a sign of being weak. Uh-huh. And I left.
Wow. So one other question that I can't, leave this conversation without asking you is, what is the role that your relationship with your wife played in your ability to do all of this?
I was doing it before I met her.
Yeah.
And she has since, like, encouraged me, you know, quite a bit, and been there for me a lot in those dark moments where I didn't want to quit. And she always believed in my vision and believed in me. So that's been really huge. I think part of it too is her belief in me allowed me to think bigger than, you know, I have to be successful in this one context. And I think that was another thing that allowed me just to move on when I really needed to. Mm-hmm. The other thing was too, is like, you know, I was putting her through a lot. So yeah. I would work all day, and then I would go out in the evening and come home at like 9 at night, sometimes 2:30 at night. And that's not a heck of a marriage for her. And all the time I was promising her all this financial freedom. And mm-hmm. after, you know, long enough, years of doing that, you start to feel like this is not what either of us were agreeing upon. And I had to just figure, she wasn't happy, I wasn't happy. And, you know, part of the decision to leave was like, hey, we got to find something better for us.
Yeah.
And we ended up, you know, moving to California and changing our life completely. But yeah.
We're going to talk about that as well. You know, one other part that I want to talk about as we wrap up this sort of first segment of our conversation is, I know religion played a big role in your life for quite some time, and I'm curious kind of how that evolved over time. And also, you know, one of the things that you and I were talking about is, you know, part of leaving the situation that you were in is basically loss aversion, right? That occurs. So let's talk about both of those things.
Yeah, actually that reminds me of other reasons why I wasn't quitting. Actually, something that we talked about before was loss aversion and sunk cost. Mm-hmm. And when you go out there in cold winter nights and commit as hard as I did, you know, it's hard just to walk away from it because you really want to reap the returns. One of the other things is I made it through a point in my life where I was like rebellious skateboarder, and I was ready to have some order. And Amway brought that. I started experiencing mentors in my life for the first time, and these cool events of all sorts of, almost like Tony Robbins type events. And the organization that I was a part of was very religious. And I wasn't into it at first, but I've always had kind of like a bent for spirituality. I had a lot of existential questions as a child. So I finally got around some people that I respected, and I joined the religion that they were really, really strong about, and is Christianity. And one of the things that ended up happening with that business and that team was that they started twisting business and religion together. So it became not just about, hey, you need to enroll these people to build out a team and make money and have financial freedom, but then it started changing and morphing into, hey, you need to enroll these people so that they could be saved from hell, or, you know, come to Jesus, or, you know, and it sounds really weird now, but that was a big factor. So somehow I started, it was almost cultish, really, to be completely transparent. It was really hard to come out of that. But that was another reason not to quit, is my religion started being tied up with it too. And then now I'm getting more real, and And then the other thing that happens is when you join Amway and you're as committed as I am, they become your family. They become your sole reference point. They even train you on how not to seek any, you know, validation or really listen to your friends or family. Mm-hmm. And I learned later I was studying cults because essentially, in my opinion, I did get sucked into a cult type bubble. And I was looking at the pattern and I felt stupid. You know, one of my biggest fears, as you heard earlier, is I just didn't want to ever find out that I was stupid. And I felt stupid. And I was like, how did somebody as smart as me and having as great of, you know, parents and all this stuff, how did I end up in this whole like crazy worldview? You know, I can justify it in a lot of different ways, but one of the things that I learned later was that the same patterns that the network marketing companies use, sometimes some religions or even some corporations or startups, is they're very cultish. So if any organization starts telling you to only seek them for validation, to stop listening to other people,
right,
that's a pretty major red flag. And I'm going to have a big problem with anyone that I hear saying something like that.
Sure.
So that was a big part of it too, of not wanting to quit. Is my, you know, when you really get in touch with spirituality, especially a religion like Christianity, where it's such high stakes, where either people are going to be in heaven or they're going to be in hell. I mean, does it get more high stakes than that for all of eternity? Yeah, so that's, you get this hero complex too.
Yeah.
You're trying to save the world and all this stuff. So all that made it extremely hard to leave. Hmm. And I had to have a lot of really difficult conversations with myself and in order to just unravel all of that and just become real with what actually happened. And it ended up being, I wanted to get in for financial independence, but the more you get sucked in, the more you start changing the reason you got in, and now you're doing it for reasons that you never even signed up for, and no one ever admitted that they were really wanting to get you to be a part of. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I have a lot of mixed feelings about, you know, that point in my life, that season. It was 7 years.
No,
it was a long window. And what was interesting is I was still holding down successful jobs otherwise. Like I was moving up in kind of the IT world, and
You know, one of the things that I know you and I have talked about is that these sort of intense periods of our lives, periods of grief or periods of turmoil, they tend to leave imprints that, you know, you have triggers from years later, you know, to the point where these things are still on your mind. And I'm curious, you know, like how, and this is probably a big question, but how did you finally let go of all of that stuff? I mean, because that's a lot to deal with.
Yeah, well, I had somebody that helped me. So strangely enough, my wife and I got to a point where we were so frustrated with the leadership because we started seeing how this religious stuff was impacting the people that we were bringing in. So we would bring somebody into the organization, and next thing you know, they're talking about how if you vote Democrat, you're going to hell. Like just crazy stuff. And we're like, okay, this is really messed up, and now we're never going to be successful with these, because I never bought into any of that type of BS.
Yeah.
So we started being really real with ourselves and going, man, we were looking all the way up through your organization of the team that we're a part of, and we saw no one that was capable of helping us. So we really get to our dreams, our goals. And so we had to start looking around, and there was a guy that I had respected for a long time in that business. His name's Dean Kosegi, and the night before we met him, and we were praying, again, very religious at the time, and we were praying that, you know, if we're supposed to be in the business still, that God would give us a sign and let us know. So the next day, I ended up seeing that this guy was coming into town, and he said, hey, if anyone wants to grab coffee, and to put it in perspective, this guy would speak in front of 30,000 people all over the world, very famous, very hard to reach. And I sent him a message on Facebook and said, hey, my wife and I would love to meet you. And he said, well, you can be my guest tonight. And that was just insane because I wanted to meet this guy just enough to shake his hand one day.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into our life and we talked about everything that we're going through and all the weird stuff. And he had been around this business enough to know that there was organizations like ours that were just being very, and by the way, Amway is completely against all this stuff. I should say that Amway as a company is against that. They have rules against the type of teachings and things that were happening, but that team was breaking them.
Mm-hmm.
Though Amway was turning a blind eye, they were aware of it.
Yeah.
So he ended up explaining to us how weird all that stuff was and how he had to break out of it himself. And he was extremely successful, multimillionaire in the business. And he just looked at us and he was like, gosh, you guys are, we stayed up with them until like 3 in the morning in this hotel suite in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mm-hmm. He said, if you guys are serious about the dreams that you want, I mean, it's clear. He's like, I'm looking at your wife, Brian, and you guys, you need to make a change. And he said, if you're serious, you need to move out to California and just get away from all this. You need to change your environment. You need to start meeting more people. You need to start meeting successful people that are not a part of this thing. And you need to start like detoxing from all this. And so he was, you know, we prayed very hard. And then the next day that happened. And then we ended up leaving the organization, which was very painful because, as I mentioned, that I was with it for 7 years and they become almost like family. And I ended up, when I told one of my mentors at the time that we were going to explore working with this guy, Dean, he texted me and said, nice knowing you. And, wow. And that was it. And you know, and then he went on to tell my other good friends in the business that we had been deceived by Satan and all this other stuff. So just super weird. Embarrassed even talking about it now. But yeah, so it was fairly traumatic to have happen, and it took time. It took years. Thankfully, I had somebody with me that had gone through something like that. You know, Dean helped me through it, and just had to learn how to let it all go. And you know, when he texted me that, I went into shock and I was like shaking and stuff. Like, it was so weird, just the emotional bullet that was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I ended up, you know, it just takes time, man. And I think changing environments is huge. Like, if I was still living in the same house, spending time with the same people, doing the same activities, you know, being in all the same environments, I probably would still be fairly scarred and maybe like far less of a, you know, of a person now. But I just, changing all of my environments was huge. So I was able to rebuild an identity very quickly by moving across the country.
All right. Well, we will pick up how to rebuild an identity in the next half of our conversation. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.